Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I know there's some concern about the summer, the upcoming summer in Chicago with the departure of City Hall Chief of Staff Rich Gaitis. But because there's a lot of stuff going on this summer, you've got Pritzker's coming out party,
stop it.
The DNC, you got your NASCAR, you got your Lollapalooza, you got your first open swim on the Chicago River in 100 years.
Yeah, that's going to be great. I mean, I'm already going to sign up. I mean, registration is open. It's September 22nd. What could go wrong? I mean, you might find a body part or something, maybe.
It's a worthy cause. You know, these swimmers are raising money for ALS, so I don't want to denigrate the cause, but I don't know if that this is the most appealing way to do it. Again, MWRD has said they're going to be tracking the water quality every 15 minutes. So if you're uncomfortable with the amount of fecal matter per million cubic feet of water, then at any time you can get out of the pool, as it were, I suppose. Well, you can jump on one of those boats with the bathtubs or the spas, and they'll take you down the rest of their track.
Or just hide behind one. I'm like, go, go. I was going to say, just hope the Dave Matthews Band isn't part of Lollapalooza or isn't in town that weekend. Fest, you know, that's in September.
Although, to be fair to the Dave Matthews Band, I mean, if it wasn't such a spectacle, nobody would have noticed, given the amount of untreated sewage that's in the Chicago River on a daily basis, on a regular basis. So, you know, it'd be a little bit fair.
They dumped in broad daylight.
I mean, familiar with the story. Accidents,
I know, but
will
it still
happen.
Makes me laugh.
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, it was at the Eastland, you know.
I know,
yeah. And, you know, so again, it's a worthy cause. Anyway, so there's a lot of big events coming up. And so you need a steady hand to navigate these fecal infested waters. And so we have one now. Christine Zayas, fresh off of her brilliant architecting of the response to the migrant matter. She has now been elevated, and her service in the Illinois General Assembly, which is, you know, a great proving ground. She has now been elevated to Chief of Staff. Christine Zayas is your new Chief of Staff. And Rich Gaitis is flipped. He's the Development Director for Blue Star Security now. I wonder how many city contracts for the security services at places like Lollapalooza and other big events. But anyway, I digress. You know, that's how it goes in Chicago. No big deal. Christina Zayas, the architect of the migrant response, your new BLM brand and Chief of Staff.
312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. You can also reach us on our text line, which is fired up and ready to go, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. But everybody knew that she was going to be taking over once Richard left. But we all thought that he was going to stay here until after this summer of whatever this is. What do you want to call this upcoming summer? Summer of confusion? Summer of... Because it can't be the summer of love.
It's taken. Summer of joy is taken.
Yeah.
We've already experienced the summers of love and joy, so...
Yeah, summer of traffic. Well, no.
No, I'll have to... Yeah, that's a good question. We should start the branding, the marketing of this right now. Remember, you have to cater to the Foley 2.8 million or... Maybe let's say 1.5 million, half the city. The Foley Day 1.5 million, which is the delusion, the shared delusion. So you have to cater to the shared delusion when you think about terming the summer and marketing it. 312-642-5600, turnkey.proanswerline. Won't you help us with that?
Summer of, It's the summer of stuff. I mean, there is so much stuff going on. And then they moved school back a week, and
right, that's really seismic.
Well, you're planning, and you hit planned games, and everything was going to happen, and then they moved it back because the DNC's in town.
Well, I mean, while we're thinking about the summer of blank, I love I can't even think of the game. I can't think of the name for the summer, and I can't think of the game. The game show.
Oh.
The summer of blank. And Charles Nelson Reilly would come up with something humorous. What was that? Not password.
I'm looking to Justin for help. Gosh. Do you think Justin?
Oh, yeah, Justin. That show was on about 40 years before he was born.
Come on, Justin.
All right. So, but anyway, just on the migrant matter, since that's the newly minted chief of staff's calling card, Christine Zayas, state legislator. Yeah. And again, state legislator, as you know, the state legislature here, the General Assembly, is just chock full of talent. Oh. So people that are very, very good at a lot of things, and they've chosen public service. This is the story, and again, I'm catering to self-delusion here. They've chosen public service. They could have done many things. They could have been a billionaire tech entrepreneur like J.B. Pritzker, speaking of self-delusion. They could have they could have colonized Mars. They could be splitting atoms. They could be
finding a cure for cancer.
Yeah, they could be an engineer at SpaceX. Plotting the great beyond. They could be doing so much. They chose public service first to work in the General Assembly to make sure that Illinois becomes or maintains its status as this magnet for jobs and capital and innovation. The model for the country, and some people will go the extra mile, like Christine Zayas, will come back to the city that she loves, say, I am giving up my office to serve the city, to help cope with the Biden buddies that we're welcoming into the city. And now I'm going to take that next step to help manage all of what goes on in this city to make this the greatest city the world has ever seen, to continue that.
Right.
So that's I mean, again, let's recognize the sacrifices that Christina Zayas has made. All of our office holders have made to give up all the things they could be doing, all the money they could be making, all the notoriety they could be gaining, the peace settlements they could be negotiating to, manage that open swim.
Match game, by the way.
Match game. Thank you very much.
Oh, we have lots of text messages.
I figured.
But I interrupt you. I'm sorry. Summer of chaos. The summer of pride.
Match. Gene Rayburn, right? Gene Rayburn was the host of Match Game. I think I have that right. All right. At least I'm redeemed myself somewhat. But anyway, just that backdrop on Christine's eyes, because I don't want to make people uncomfortable, but there are some ne'er-do-wells, some ingrates in Chicago that don't appreciate all that Christina Zayas has sacrificed to take on this role, to already do what she's done in successfully game planning the welcoming of the Biden buddies. One of the nattering nabobs of negativism is this lovely woman, Kata Truss, who actually was on with Lawrence Jones. We played a clip from her a few weeks back. She was on with Lawrence Jones on Fox and Friends. Well, she's gone full Trump at this point.
Really? Good.
Lifelong Democrat, and not anymore.
All right, so I noticed your hat, Chicago for Trump. What is the story? Who are you, and what's the story behind that hat?
Well, first of all, my name is Kata Truss, and I am a Chicagoan, and I was a lifelong Democrat until I really started paying attention to the Democratic policies and how they were hurting the city of Chicago. And I had decided that I had just had enough, and the migrant crisis
The migrant crisis
took me over the edge.
What is that looking like in your city right now, the migrant crisis?
It is looking like a mess. It is a mess, and that's exactly what it is. But, I started paying attention to not just the migrant crisis, but the Democratic policies and how those policies have really hurt, not helped us. And I just decided I have to get off this ride and go for a winner.
Well, one down, 1.5 or so million to go in the city of Chicago. But the migrant crisis is something that apparently roiled Kate Cutatrus and pushed her all the way over to, Streeterville and base camp for Trump. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line.
Text messages, too. 64636, type in DA and tell us. What it's going to be, the summer of what?
Tony Southside.
Good morning, Amy Lamb. Good morning, Dan. Dan, you already got the name. It should be called the Summer of Self-Delusion.
Simple. Yeah.
You got it, bro.
All right.
I know it's not catching, but it's the truth.
Thanks for the call, Tony. I like the sinister laugh, too. But the, I don't, it's not catchy enough. I mean, not that Summer of Love and Summer of Joy is particularly catchy, but we hold ourselves to higher standards.
Chirac Sunshine, somebody texted in.
Summer of Chirac Sunshine, also not catchy. Jerry Gurney.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. How about the Summer of Visibility?
Oh, visibility, right. That's a favorite word. Thanks for the call, Jerry. Right. I see you robbing me. I see you squatting on my property. I see you. I hear you creeping in my back door. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. How about the Summer of Total Confusion?
All right. Thanks for the call, Rich. Franklin in McHenry. Franklin.
No.
McHenry.
Turn down your radio.
Franklin.
Hey, what you said?
Yes.
Oh,
no, Franklin. There he is. Franklin, you're on.
Dan, listen, the floating fecal matter in the Chicago River can be used as life preservers for any exhausted swimmers.
It's true.
And I heard
it's floating.
I heard Chicago recently purchased a new helicopter just for the DNC convention.
Yeah, they have two new ones.
And I think they're going to need it for when the city goes down in flames.
Yeah. I think they're going to need, they may need some Black Hawk helicopters.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Business owners, now's the time for your business to make the move to a locally owned business bank. Hi, Mike Gallagher here to let you know that you don't have to look far. Signature Bank was founded in Chicago with a simple mission to help companies like yours grow, succeed, and thrive. Their decisions are made locally by a terrific team that knows your name, cares about your business, and invests in your success. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. I'm a customer. As business owners, they knew that local family-owned businesses were not getting the help they needed or deserved. So I invite you to reach out to my friends at Signature Bank today. Write the number down. Remember this phone number, Signature Bank, 773-467-5630, and learn all about this great bank, 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Before we get to the squatters,
this
text from Amish Texter, not about naming the upcoming Chicago summer, but this open swim, which also needs some marketing, too.
Yep.
First open swim in the Chicago River in 100 years, raising money for ALS. Amish Texter, how about Swimmeria?
Oh.
It's not bad.
I got one for that. Texted in, Chicago, just dive in. I can't wait. I might do this, though. Do this swim. We're going to start at Clark and Dearborn and then go east to Wabash and then circle back at Wolf Point. Do you want to sponsor me, Dan?
Sure. I mean, if you want to ingest fecal matter and navigate around decomposing bodies, if you think that's enjoyable. I mean, it's a worthy cause, But I'd rather maybe do like a polar plunge or maybe just write a check from the comfort of my home. But anyway, hey, if you want to do it, I will sponsor you. Sure.
Okay.
I'll.
I can get a wetsuit that says, you know, follow Dan at Dan Prof. No.
I think I hope there's some sort of like incentive structure, like bonus structure, like, you know, five K, like a $10 a mile, $100 a mile, whatever, or a kilometer. How about this? How about like I'll give you $1,000 for every body that you identify.
Stop it! Like, I've been looking for that one. Oh, there's that one from that murder we covered in 2000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to that guy? Oh, there he is.
Oh.
Uh-huh. Did you have some summer
great.
Of fill in the blank? We're playing the match game here.
This is really good. Summer of bovine excrement. No, I don't like that one.
Excrement.
Did I say excrement? I meant excrement. Yeah. Summer of illusions. Summer of sanctuary. We're getting better.
Summer of sanctuary is not bad.
Getting good. But I already know what
sanctuary
the
summer.
Yeah. Sanctuary Summer is another one. This is a winner. Let me see if there's a few more. Ready?
Yeah.
Summer of Gimme Dat.
Gimme Dat Summer. Gimme Dat, not Summer of. Gimme Dat Summer.
Gimme Dat Summer.
That is good. I think that's a good one.
I
don't know why.
I read it. Yeah. Like, it's over. Game over.
Gimme Dat Summer.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's definitely the leader in the clubhouse. Okay, all right. See if you can be Gimme Dat Summer. 312-642-5600 turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA turnkey.pro text line.
Oh, here's another one. Ooh, Summer of Silly. Oh, that's good.
Yeah, I was thinking that. I was thinking Summer of Silly Kids.
Summer of Silly Kids.
Yes. Yeah, there's something there. I think Gimme Dat covers more ground. Gimme Dat Summer.
What about Gimme Dat Silly Summer? No, that's too much.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. I think we're over the target, though. All right. Unless somebody wants to do, you know, come with something that we don't see, come from a different angle. 312-642-5600 turnkey dot pro answer line. I want to talk about squatters again, because you know, these stories won't go away, just like the squatters won't, and they're being protected by your city and state governments,
and
at least in big metropolitan areas and states dominated by said big metropolitan areas, like, I don't know, Chicago and Illinois. New York, it seems to be where it's most acute. I'm sure rent control has something to do with that, and they're actually just making it worse with this new eviction law that's being moved, making it more punishing on the productive and the law-abiding, because that's what you're in for if you choose to reside in a place like New York City and Chicago these days. And just like we talk about repeat violent crime in these same locales, and it's indigenous and our new Biden buddies, well, it's the same thing with squatters. I mean, it's just another form of crime, if we're being honest. More honest than our political leadership. This is a particularly unnerving story, you might say.
Okay.
Story of illegal migrant criminals. Boy, that's covering a lot of territory. So the Biden buddies that came here, they've committed crimes and they're squatting. And they, of course, they won't leave. And, of course, the authorities won't do anything about it. Here's the ABC affiliate in New York City. ABC 7 there, too, reporting.
They're squatters, you know, and the owner has been trying to get them out of the apartment for the longest period of time. And I think he has a court date set. Apparently, because they're squatters of more than 30 days, they came and they were kind of a disruptive force, mainly because they were a lot of them, you know. And you didn't know who was staying there or not staying there. And, you know, the owner of the building had a hell of a time trying to get them out.
Now, De Sosa, Villata, and seven others were charged with criminal possession of a weapon, criminal possession of a controlled substance, and acting in a manner injurious to a child. All but two were released without bail. Now, Villata was already charged with attempted murder for shooting another person in the leg that was over in Yonkers. As for these other suspects, they are being investigated right now, all tied to a string of robberies that...
Yeah, that you heard that right. Six of the eight gun-toting, drug-dealing migrant squatters busted in the Bronx were cut loose without bail. Endangering a child, attempted murder.
And this house was right across the street from a school, by the way.
That's right. Well, they've been there for 30 days, so what are you going to do?
So that they automatically become legal tenants due to that New York law. I mean, we're like in clown world.
And if you think this is just in the rough and tumble streets of the Bronx, in Jamaica, New York, a couple is being sued by squatters for expelling them from their $930,000 home. The squatters used as proof of occupancy, among other things,
what?
A $25 Shake Shack receipt. They had Shake Shack delivered to the house. Look, we live here.
They're getting creative.
Who needs a lease when you have a Shake Shack receipt? A possession of a Shake Shack receipt is 9/10 of the law, as everyone knows. This is spawning a new industry. So again, you know, the squatters, I suppose we should thank them, spawning a new industry in New York, real estate agents who serve the squatting community.
What?
My name is Brad Bradley, and I'm the first real estate agent to take care of all of your New York squatting needs. So this right here is a wonderful pre-squatted four-bedroom, great for entertaining, fantastic starter squatter for a new couple if you want to start small. You know, there's a lot of people in New York that want to be a homeowner, but they're not interested in putting a down payment on a house. There's actually a multi-family unit that's going to be going on the squatting market real soon. Really nice bones on this one. Hello? I think we're still good. So we got two empty garbage bins here, which is a really good sign that some vacancies might be opening up. A lady actually just inherited this place, but she's insanely busy with the funeral arrangements at the moment, so plenty of options for squatting start dates. Have you noticed that these people have been gone for a while?
No.
With all the travel schedules of New York residents, to help you find the perfect house to take over by squatting in it. Are you a homeowner? Traditional or squat? You the owner of this one?
Almost 30 years.
Do you ever go on long vacations?
Yeah.
When's the next one planned?
Summer.
August or?
End of August.
Also, when you do the August trip, if you wanted to extend it a little longer, you know what I mean? It's an option. Well, you never say never. It could be 3 months. So we could probably start doing some showings there late August. I'm always doing market research. I'm always looking for new leads of properties that could be right for you. You know, Ring Cam, that's good. I'm going to give this one another couple of days, and I think I might start doing some showings here. We do property showings, create fake leases. And I've developed relationships with law enforcement to help ease the transition by having the previous owner arrested if they do try to kick you out. They got that glass that you can't really see through, so I took some pictures last night from a building over. So the owner here apparently has plans to go surfing in Australia for a few months, so it's going to be a costly trip, mate. I think I was seen there. Low crime area, which is very important. I wouldn't want any of my clients to have their newly squatted home burglarized by criminals.
Looks like this is great.
That's the satirical stylings of Ryan Long, but not, you know, as
not that far off.
The best you can do these days with satire is be about 5 degrees from reality. Clay in Libertyville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, Dan. Morning, Amy. I'm saying the summer of benignancy. Try to class it up a little.
Common
bit.
Spelling, yeah.
Wow. Wow. All right. I think that's a bit beyond the reach of the majority of Chicagoans who are going to be ingesting fecal matter this summer. Thanks for the call, Clay. Ooh. Rick in LaPorte, Indiana, that is.
Yeah. How about the summer of waste?
Democrats double entendre.
They waste time and they waste money.
And they put waste in the river. We got a threefer. Thanks for the call, Rick. George, Naperville.
Dan, how about the summer of dumb? I think everybody's brain is going soft with all this comedy.
Thanks for the call, George. All right. So where are we at? Let's get back. I mean, the squatter stuff is fun, too, except for people whose homes are being essentially taken from them.
I told you, my friend, well, he worked at Fox 32. He had squatters. He went on an extended vacation, came back, and they did not leave. It was people that he kind of sort of knew, but they moved in, and they had they changed the names on the electric bills, water bills, and their name. And then it took 6 months to get them out. You have to go to court, and then you have to file all this paperwork, and then you have to hire an attorney. You have to spend all this money. And the documents that he needed were inside his own condo. So then he had to get a court order to be allowed into his own condo to get the papers out.
Yeah, the laws in Cook County are not dissimilar, and the Cook County Sheriff is too busy, you know, doing staged puppy rescues to evict anybody. In addition to that's a constituency that they serve, the law-breaking community. So they can't both serve the law-breaking community and the law-abiding community. They have to pick one, and I think you know which one they've picked. Now, we brought you this story the other week when we talked about this too, and actually I have a commentary that's I find quite entertaining at American Greatness on the topic too, if you want to check that out. But Flash Shelton had this happen to him, something like you're describing happened to your friend Amy. And every business solves a problem. So it started when he was treated to squatters at his mom's house that he inherited.
Okay. Well, Flash Shelton came up with a clever idea.
This man is on a mission to take back his parents' house after he says squatters moved in.
I just felt like, you know, if they can take a house, I can take a house.
This was his mom's house. She left it briefly after his dad passed away. When squatters took over the house, Shelton did what I would have done.
I called law enforcement, and there was nothing they could do.
Why can't the cops evict somebody?
Because the crazy laws don't allow them to.
So Shelton came up with this bizarre solution.
Oh, I realized I could go in as the squatter myself, gain possession of the property.
Because the law so favors squatters, he became a squatter. When the home invaders left for a few hours, Shelton slipped into the house and changed the locks.
I had them locked out before they even knew that somebody wanted them out.
The squatter comes back, finds the door locked, screams, says, "I have a right to be there," and you just don't let him in?
I don't let him in.
That's where we're at now, because you can't. You can't rely on law enforcement to protect your private property rights. You have to out-squat the squatters. In other words, you have to out-lawbreak the lawbreakers. Now, there's another way to do this, too. I mean, I'm not going to go into detail, but I think some people listening probably have the same idea that I did. I would do what Flash Shelton did with the squatters. I would bring some of my friends over, too.
Oh.
But it wouldn't be to out-squat the squatter, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It would be to
go in there and kick the bums out, right?
You may find the squatters on that open swim course that Amy is going to traverse this summer, I guess would be my point. But I mean but in a serious note, that's where it's at. What do we say all the time? This government, these governments, Chicago, Illinois, New York City, New York State, any metropolitan area of size, they put people in positions they don't want to be in. They didn't choose to be in. They don't want to be in. They play by the rules, and they're forced into positions that are threatening or debilitating by their government. And that's no joke. April in Plainfield, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, I was thinking infectious fun and summer of psychosis.
Oh, so, no, that's pretty good. Ooh, infectious, yes. Yes, it is.
Text message, Chicago River swim, like swimming in your own colonoscopy bag. No, that's not funny.
Colostomy bag.
I can't see today.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. The allergies.
It is vivid. I mean, I could see the imagery
for
marketing materials. Ralph and Rantoul.
Thanks for the Give Me Dad. I think Give Me Dad would work, but for this one, I think I like Cruel Summer because it
Bananarama
with it built in.
Yeah, is that Bananarama?
Yeah, it is Bananarama.
Yeah. I think so.
Are you going to say? Do you have a version of Cruel Summer specifically for Chicago?
You know what? I'm an excellent lyricist, and give me about 10 minutes, and I think that I could come up with something quite workable.
All right, call
you
back.
You think you're a better lyricist than Bananarama? Is that what you're saying?
Well. I don't know about better, but I think good.
All right. Ralph and Rantoul, again, we have to give credit where credit's due. He is the marketing genius behind the Gimme Dat marketing for the forthcoming BLM Brandon taxpayer-funded empire. That's where the Gimme Dat summer comes from. And so, I mean, we're going to give you wide berth here. You're a marketing genius for Marxists.
For the last one, too, somebody talked about a colostomy bag. I would broaden it a little bit, and you could call it, a colonoscopy prep sort of thing, because one of the more popular ones out there, you could, I could work with that too, you know, but it's a family show.
Like so that's conjuring up images like a porta potty summer, you know?
What about the summer of gimme gimme? So somebody texted in.
No.
Summer of waste.
I am looking. Well, we heard that from our friend in Laporte, but I'm looking forward, I must say, to Frank's Chicago oriented rendition of Cruel Summer. And we're gonna have to get through it. Let's cue up the music bed from Bananarama's Cruel Summer in anticipation. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So do you have times where between these hours I don't accept work-related texts or emails or calls?
Well, I try to give myself 1 hour a day where I just disconnect. And that time is yoga time.
And what time of day is that?
That's between 9:30 and 10:30. Mr. Proft.
Okay.
But I try to. But what happens is that now years ago, no one would dare think to bring their cell phone in a yoga room. Now everybody's on their phone. Now you can see what time it is. And then during the class, people stop what they're doing and go check their phones. And I can't freaking stand it. It is my pet peeve. One lady once during the, right after the pandemic, she put her AirPods in, set up her phone on a block, and was doing a conference call during the yoga class. And that's when I stepped in. I'm like, no, we're done here. Take that outside. I'm not going
to
sit here. I didn't
pay to
watch
you
take.
Why don't you just go to a yoga studio that doesn't allow cell phones during class?
I would love to. There's none are out there. Even the studio in Utah used to never. They abided by the rules, leave cell phones outside. And now everybody has their cell phones in.
Well, outside of the hour a day for your yoga class, I'm thinking more like, you know, work hours, like people who work a normal day, not because our day is a little abnormal here.
Yeah, but we work all the time. I mean, we always have our phones on, right, for tweeting, social media, for work, in case somebody has a tip or a story or something.
Well, so that's the question is, so, you know, let's just for sake of argument, your 9-to-5 work day. After 5 o'clock, when the work whistle blows, because we all live in the Fred Flintstone era, do you say, okay, the boss knows, the culture is, I personally have made a choice and communicated that, look, I'm not going to respond or take work calls, emails, texts until 9 o'clock the next day, or whatever the time is. But you get the point that there's a strict cutoff time that must be abided, and I'm the shot caller when it comes to that time. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line.
If I did have a 9-to-5 job, I don't know if I could do that. I think I'd have to keep my laptop on, my phone on, ready to take, because you've got customers, and customers are always right. You always want to make sure that you maintain that customer base. So if there's a problem, you want to be there for them. But that's
I think you may want to reflect on your work-life balance.
Yeah, that's true.
No, I'm kidding. Oh. I totally don't mean that. I hate that phrase. That's just more of like the psychobabble of the age. Yeah, my work life. Okay. Yeah, I'm going to go take a yoga class and listen to people talk on their cell phones while I reflect on my work-life balance. So the reason I ask is because some people apparently do, and maybe in some workplaces that is not copacetic. And so you know what you need.
What?
You need the state to step in and regulate your workplace for you in this area as well. And that's exactly what California is doing. And if they're doing it in California, you can bet that some enterprising legislator in Springfield will take up this issue as well. Inspired by Australia's right to disconnect law, some dink from San Francisco named Matt Haney has introduced legislation that would grant California employees the legal right. The legal right. So if you violated this legal right, then you would face potentially legal exposure. Legal right to ignore calls, emails, and texts after hours. It would make California the first state in the country to give employees the legal right to tell their bosses do not disturb. Matt Haney, this is a dink from San Francisco. People now find themselves always on and never off.
Oh, God.
Oh, it's tragic.
Jeez.
It's oppressive. There's an availability creep that has reached into many people's lives, and I think it's not a positive thing for people's happiness, for their well-being, or even for work productivity. Thank goodness that Matt Haney is here to tell you be your great protector when it comes to your happiness, your well-being, and, of course, on the employer side, too, because he serves everyone.
Right.
What is best for worker productivity in your workplace? It's wonderful. Wonderful. Haney highlighted the challenges posed by remote work, which worsened during the COVID-19 pandemic because of dinks like Haney who locked down the economy. But I digress. This is not intended to say people can't work long hours or have an agreement for a contract where they're on call. But it should be made clear. The problem we have now is the gray area where an employee is expected to respond all the time when on paper they work a 9-to-5 job. Exactly. And if there's a gray area, that's where your state legislature should intervene and adjudicate the matter between employer and employee, just like in every other matter between employer and employee, between parent and child, between everybody and everybody else. Your duly elected state legislator, congresswoman, governor is always there to intervene in every aspect of your life because they're protecting both sides. They're keeping everybody safe. They're making everybody happier and more productive. It's wonderful to have Matt Haney in an elected position and all the Matt Haneys all over the country. Isn't it wonderful?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. You can also reach us on our text line, 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Real quick, when you're on the golf course, do you take phone calls? Do you take text messages? What do you do?
I mean, I don't turn my phone off. Okay. So I don't take calls, generally speaking, unless it's urgent. But I mean, and some courses you can't, you certainly can't take a call. Some courses you can't have your phone out there technically.
Really?
Chicago Golf is one. And there are others. So I get it. That's the whole thing. It's like I can regulate my life for myself. Matt Haney and all the similar Matt Haneys in Springfield. And, and to the extent I've got to figure something out at work for a conference call or for an availability. I got it. Please, Matt Haney. No, but you don't understand, Dan. There's a power relationship in the employee and the employer. It's an oppressor. Yeah, okay. All right.
He wants to help balance your work life.
I know. Yeah. I really appreciate it. And so, I mean, all of this stuff, number one, it's an interpersonal relationship or a professional relationship that people manage privately. That's how it should be. it's amazing. I have to say something as I which I think is as simplistic as that, but these are the times in which we live. The other thing is, can you exercise any restraint? You don't want to take a call or a text message? So don't take the call or text message. Get back to the person when you can. Get back, you know, respond to the email. You know, the 24-hour rule, I think, is fair if it's something that's professional, just a professional courtesy, as best you can. But, I mean, I just, like, we have to have the state always setting the rules of our private lives. They won't restrain people who violate our rights, but they're always at the ready to create new rights and to create new conflicts between law-abiding people that are in relationship with one another, either personally or professionally. Don't you find that a bit ironic?
We don't need to be babied.
That's a simpler way to say it. Terry, Rogers Park.
People on phones all the time don't know how to have conversations with real people anymore, and it's sickening to see that.
Sorry, Terry, I was checking my text messages. Did you say something? I'm kidding. Thank you for the call, Terry. I appreciate it. Yeah, I get it, and I'm guilty of that sometimes too. If you're at a friend, you know, you're with a friend for a drink or dinner or whatever, and you check your text message, and he's saying something, and then you're texting something quick. But I can do both.
Yeah, but it's rude. And I've seen you do that. I'm like, Dan.
Yeah, then I put, but I'm listening. But then I put my phone down, and then I contribute mightily to the interchange.
Oh, of course you do.
Yeah, right.
Wait, did you say something? It was texting.
Yeah.
Oh.
Karen and Beecher.
Oh, good morning, my dears. Pardon. May I offer my summer suggestion first before my comment?
You may.
Thank you. My suggestion was Summer of Stool and Tools.
Summer of Stools and Tools.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
But I don't need any bureaucrat dweeb telling me what to do. I regulate my own life. And when my kids were in my house and they were growing up, nobody was you could call my house, but we were absolutely not answering the phone or anything during dinner hour, whether it was 5 to 6, 6 to 7, 5:30 to 6:30. No, you could call all you want, leave all the messages, but nobody was talking on the phone. That was our time. And I when the four of us are together, no, my husband will be on his phone because he has to work 24/7. You know why, but whatever. I will not ever pick up my phone. And when I was working, I refused to answer any email outside of work until I got back to school at 7 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for the call, Karen. Yeah. It's funny that the dinner thing. So I agree with you. I mean, the way it was, my household when I was growing up, we didn't, you know, this is pre answering machine. Remember answering machines?
Yeah, and
before
then call waiting,
voicemail.
Yeah.
So if the phone rang, it was just going to keep ringing. So, you know, my mom or dad would answer and say, you know, we're having dinner right now. We'll call you back. And that's that. Amazingly, we didn't need the legislature to confer a right that provided us like civil action against the person who called us between 5 and 6 p.m. Because what you were supposed to do at dinner is sit in silence and eat your dinner, which is what we did.
Well, and then talk about your day.
No.
Probably didn't.
No. Sit in silence and eat your dinner. No interruptions from people calling on the phone, and no interruptions from family members. Exactly. But yeah, I do remember. I mean, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that in years, but I do remember the dinner time thing and the no phone calls. No leaving the dinner table without an excuse kind of thing.
No, and still to this day, my kids, we always have dinner together, and cell phones, don't bring them to the table, and they don't. And if I catch them, I'm like, put that over on the counter. And then they can't, when they stand up, I'm like, no, where are you going? We're still talking.
And how? Yeah, right. Go exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Listen,
we're still talking, meaning we have to listen to mom some more. I already told you everything I have to tell you about my day. What else happened? Nothing.
But what's the best, worst part?
Can
of
I just
day?
Go? Can I just go?
I do that. I'm not kidding you. I do that.
I bet they ate like in under 5 minutes. Right.
I don't want you to be right, but you're right. Yeah. Well, sometimes
well,
it
that's
was
because that's what I did too. I'm like, I'm losing my mind here.
Well, they had things to do, you know, homework.
Yeah.
Allegedly.
Yes. Yeah, I got people to call.
I have a life too, Mom. I think.
Tom and Berwyn.
Oh, it's funny, you guys. When I started working in the hospital setting about 30 years ago, they used a thing called a pager.
Oh,
you
yeah.
just hung on your belt and
so,
So fast forward to the time we're in now. Everybody's using cell phones except me. And when I have a pager on and the nurses see me, they say, oh, my God, I'm using a pager. Holy cow, look at this. You know, and it's like, it just interrupts. If you have a cell phone, to me, you walk into a patient's room. It interrupts the contact that you're trying to make. And
good for you.
Wait, you're a doctor?
I'm a physical therapist.
Oh, a physical therapist. So you're a museum piece. You literally use a pager. That's how people get a.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, without a doubt. I come to work and I'll see a single pager that's for our department, and the battery's dead. I have to put a new battery in, and I'll wear it that day. I tell the nurses.
Anybody have a pager charger? What kind of pager? I just want to check up because one of my first gigs out of the state, out of college, I worked for Lee Daniels and House Republicans, whatever. So I was a state employee. We had pagers.
We had pagers. NBC5.
And so does the code still work? Like 911 if it's a call, obviously emergency, and 811 if it's not quite an emergency, but I need you to call me back soon. Is that still the nomenclature?
Actually, no. What they have is I've got my own number, which is a 5-digit number. So they get on a telephone, a regular telephone or a cell phone, and they just dial those 5 numbers after they get onto that paging system. And then I get the little and read what they want you to know.
Oh, I see. Yeah, right. Because you can at least the pagers have upgraded to being able to actually text something as opposed to just the number. I see.
My pager always ended up
in
the toilet.
Text. Don't use the word text. Though. It's page. Page. If I use the word text, they laugh at me. Oh. The pager.
That's great.
Thanks for the call. So it's pager.
I just went back to my happy place. I liked, I loved having a pager. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
But then cell phones were.
I like the pager idea too because it's a lot easier to avoid people and communicating with people.
And
yeah, I'm gonna have to think
that.
About that.
That's pager. Bring it back.
Yeah, I mean, I'm
Prof pager. They'd be like when you don't really want to talk to anybody.
I definitely belong in an analog world. There's no question about it. Dennis in Milwaukee.
Yeah, just a couple of quick points. Always love calling in and love your show every morning. Nanny state expansion, obviously. There's money in this by codifying enforcement and everything else. So
trial lawyers.
There's no money. Yeah, trial lawyers, you bet. You know, but I'd like to leave you with a picture this morning. That is that I really like to have a lethal bear trap we can stick inside the flap of his tent every time the camel, a.k.a. the government, decides to stick their nose in it.
I like that visual. Thanks for the call, Dennis. Appreciate it. Appreciate the call. Tom in Oswego.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I've been self-employed for about 35 years. And, Dan, you mentioned about with pagers being able to avoid a call. One of the drawbacks now is with cell phones, if a customer calls and you don't return that call within about 5 minutes, they think you're ignoring them because they know you got the phone call or the voicemail. So right. It's put a lot of stress on things. My rule is, and my business is weather sensitive, so if it's storming out, I have to have it on. But when I come home at 6 o'clock, my phone goes in my office. I may look at it once in a while, but that's it. I don't keep it with me. When we go out to dinner, family, friends, what have you, I leave the phone in the car. I don't bring it in. There are times when you mentally have to have a break from this. And yeah. My business sometimes is 24/7. But I did love the days of pagers and answering machines. You had a little grace period before you had to respond to things. Not anymore.
Thanks for the call, Tom. Yeah, the you got to create. And you also have to create space to actually get some work done so you're just not always texting and responding and social media posting and so on and so forth. The only thing I'd say, if it's an urgent text at dinner with friends or something, or if I need to check my gambling app.
I've
got to, at least during March Madness and, well, frankly, most of the college basketball season. So, yeah. I mean, just know that
it's football in the fall, right?
I'm just college basketball.
Okay.
See, restraint again. Restraint is the order of the day. Everything in moderation, as Thomas Aquinas said. Will and Skokie.
Oh, hi, Will.
Hey, how you doing? Two things. First off, as far as this is concerned, I get people who call. I'm self-employed, so I answer my phone all the time. People who text me, and they'll want to text me, and they give me the details to set up an appointment, and I call them because I got some questions. And they say, well, why are you calling me? I text you.
Right.
You're not supposed to call people.
Right.
I'm like, I never got that rule. Number two, there's supposed to be a federal do not call number for people. But I get 3 or 4 or 5 calls a day from unavailable, that's what.
Yeah, well, there's spam callers and political calls, by the way.
They try to spam you. And I'm like, where was this federal do not call thing?
Let's call
our reps and have them enforce that.
Thanks for the call, Will. Well, I mean, but that federal do not, because my dad said, I'm on the federal do not call list. I keep getting these calls or these texts from candidates and stuff. I'm like, politics is exempt.
Yeah.
So don't do that. It's like the no soliciting, and then some precinct captain comes to your door, or some candidate does. Politicians are exempt. They're not selling anything, technically. They sell themselves to other people, but they're not selling anything at the doorstep.
I had somebody bring Chicago Home people, volunteers. Can we talk to you about this? I'm like, no.
But that's another thing. You don't need a law.
Right.
You don't need to call your congresswoman or your state legislative human. I mean, just handle it. It's not that onerous. But I do think I just texted you and you called me. How dare you? You're interrupting me. If I text you, you text back. But then what about if someone calls you and you text them back? Because I do that.
Oh, right.
Is that gauche and pimply?
Yeah, it is.
Hmm. All right.
Did you learn anything here this morning?
I've been called worse. Craig in Mount Greenwood.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Man, I got a good one for you because, hey, I think this summer's going to be really epic. Setting all kinds of new records in it, so it's going to have top billing. This is going to be Biden's summer of shots, squats, and gimme that.
Summer of shots, squat, and gimme that. But that's the national. You're doing a national branding campaign. Thanks for the call, Craig. We're focusing on Chicago. Chicago needs all the help it can receive. Mary Kay, Western Springs.
Hey, if you're a good employee, like this, Karen said she's going to stop answering after 5 o'clock. This law is a way to say, well, I didn't do anything after 5 o'clock because I don't have to anymore. So thank you very much. I'm done. If you're a good employee, right, you take care of your business, right? But whatever. You answer emails if you want to after 5 and control your effort into the job. Anyway, I want to bring back the busy signal. Remember the busy signal?
I think that's the forklift backup signal. I don't remember the busy signal being that aggressive.
Yeah, and you guys, phone batteries die. I go down to 1%. I'm like, now I'm done. So I can't. Yeah. I can't do anything. I can't text you back. And people do whatever is working for them. I call. I want to talk. I can't stand. My thumbs hurt by the end of the day with all the, and I must have a big thumb, because I.
Yeah, Mary Kay.
It's like a personal problem.
What? Yeah, big thumbs. You know what they say about big thumbs.
And big gloves.
I don't know.
Mary Kay, I got a suggestion for you.
What?
Pager. Thanks, Mary Kay.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
All right, listen up. Tickets are already on sale for our next big event. It is Cigar Night with Dennis Prager, presented by Control Point Engineering. It's happening at the Abington Banquets in Glen Allen on Thursday, May 23rd. Join Dennis Prager, Dan Proft, Sean Thompson for an evening of fine cigars and great conversation. Sadly, VIP tickets are already gone, but general admission tickets are still available. So make sure to get yours today at 560theanswer.com/cigar. That's 560theanswer.com/cigar. Jeannie Ives and I are going to be parking cars. We'll be working the valet out front. We'll appreciate tips and then go and enjoy yourself, because it's Dennis Prager's last cigar night, Dan. Did you know this?
Yeah. Right, exactly. I inquired about that because people were asking, like, what does that mean? What's happening to Dennis Prager? Nothing's happening to him. He's just not going to be traveling to do events like this anymore after this year, is what I understand. So he's still on the air. He's still doing his thing.
Yeah, and he's
but he's
healthy.
He's just cutting down his travel schedule. That's all.
Right. Which is understandable. 560theanswer.com/cigar.
Yeah, and it's probably just a cover story because he doesn't want to come to Illinois anymore, and who can blame him? No, he loves doing the cigar nights. We have a great time, always. We always have. So it'll be a good one, but it is the last one, so get in on it. And anybody who's met Prager, one-on-one, like at these cigar nights, really comes away enjoying him even more than they did, you know, just listening to him, because he's such a gregarious and engaging guy. He's actually a lot of fun. See, he's the most fun rabbi out there, I'd say.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Just one more note on a conversation we were having about these busybodies and these meddlers, like that Haney dink from San Francisco that wants to intervene between your employer and you and manage your life for you. This is just a remarkable statement, and I appreciate the honesty. You know, the good thing about having these useful idiot Marxists in office is they sometimes don't know what they're not supposed to say out loud.
Right.
They're just so used to sort of regurgitating the scripts they're given. So one of these, how to describe Delia Ramirez? I mean, it's pathetic. These are pathetic people. I'm not so angry at them. They're just so ill-equipped for life. I'm angry at the people who know better, which is why I usually, if you've ever listened to this show, devote most of my ire and animus mm-hmm. toward the wealthy, honky, overeducated enclaves in Chicagoland and around the country, the people who know better but are just cowards, dilettantes. They disgust me more than even Adelia Ramirez. Chronic stress, this is her tweet. Chronic stress has devastating impacts on our health and well-being. While there's action we can take to cope with stress in our lives individually, the best stress relief is policy change. Affordable housing, health care for all, student loan forgiveness, living wages, and environmental sustainability all have the power to change our lives and reduce our collective stress. Yeah, I'll tell you, she's got a point. Nothing relieves stress like being a ward of the state, where all of your choices are consequence-free, and all your wants are granted by Pauls and their henchmen who point their guns at your neighbors to demand they pay up. That's a translation of what Delia Ramirez is saying and what she and her cohorts, fellow apparatchiks, are doing. It's stress relief. Oh, yes. The munificence of the state doing violence to your neighbor so you don't have to bear any consequences for your choices, so you can have everything you want or need, must have, at somebody else's expense. Is this a proposition that is beyond the grasp of the ordinary person? I don't think so. So the question is, as it's always been, and it's more salient than it's ever been, What are people who play by the rules who are on the wrong side of that relationship? The ones that are having the gun pointed at them and being told to pay up. What are you going to do about it? All right. So let's tackle this other issue, too, because, you know, I try to find little pockets of hope on the landscape. DAI is continuing to take some hits. Diversity, inclusion, equity. Yeah. This part of our state mandated religion now. Very interesting. Very interesting. One story I'll tell you is the story of David Duvall. He spent 5 years as a senior VP at Novant Healthcare, which is a multi-billion-dollar medical group based in North Carolina. His firing in July of 2018 shocked his colleagues. There was no record of any documented criticism of Mr. Duvall's performance or reasons for his termination. His duties were given to two women upon his termination, one black, one white. When a permanent replacement was hired, all three finalists were black women. The record shows that Novant was deeply interested in the demographic makeup of its workforce. Oh, you don't say. How many PowerPoints have to circulate before people get the sense that, gosh, this seems to be pretty much everywhere. Like, there, we've reached saturation point in corporate America. Yeah, but this was May of 2018, where people were still not taking notice. At a May 2018 meeting, Novant, its Diversity Inclusion Executive Council, yeah, they had councils back then already, saw data showing a decline in women leaders. A report in February 2019 recommended a 3-4 percentage point increase in black leaders over the next 3 years. Why? You know, just to check a box, just so we can present our commitment to, you know, evidence to support our commitment to diversity for its own sake in terms of, rather than for, you know, improvement in the bottom line, for example. And I'm not saying the two are mutually exclusive. I'm saying all I care about is statistics about the demographics of my employees rather than putting together an employee group. Diversity occurs naturally when you just focus on talent that produces the best environment for employees and the best return for shareholders. But anyway, I digress. Recommended a 3-4 percentage point increase in black leaders when they wanted to recruit Hispanics and Asians, going so far as to adopt, quote, a long-term financial incentive plan that tied executive bonuses to closing those gaps. We've seen this before. This is not new, but the result of this case is to some extent. Duvall was given the "we're going in a different direction" explanation for his, yeah, you know, his termination.
It's not yet, you, it's me.
Months later, his old boss spoke to a corporate recruiter and said he'd be happy to hire Duvall again. But Duvall was let go in point of fact because Novant wanted, quote, a different point of view, a different flair. It's like right out of Office Space. Also, Duvall's supervisor went from having 7 white male direct reports in 2018 to 2 in 2019 to 1 in 2020 to 0 at the time of trial. He sued discrimination, employment discrimination, time of trial in 2021. After hearing from 10 witnesses and seeing 100 exhibits, a jury found that Novant had discriminated against Duvall owing to his race and sex. He was awarded $300,000 in punitive damages plus $2.3 million in back pay.
Whoa.
And $1.1 million as front pay in lieu of reinstatement. The Fourth Circuit reversed the punitive part, saying the damages are permitted only if an employer knowingly breaks the law or is recklessly indifferent. But the appeals court affirmed the award of comp as well as the jury's finding of discrimination. Writing, there was more than sufficient evidence for a reasonable jury to determine that Duvall's race, sex, or both motivated Novant Health's decision to fire him. Novant Health's arguments to the contrary, which largely seek a reweighting of the evidence, are unconvincing. Maybe this decision, executive, big healthcare concern, will remind corporate America and their sheepish corp councils that, you know, as you run recklessly toward quotas, based on sex and race and probably gender identity these days too, so that you get an attaboy from Larry Fink. Be careful.
Yeah.
That litigation, you know, white guys can sue in America too for now.
People forgot about that.
So that litigation can be expensive, and it can also, because of the nature of what the identitarian left has done to the culture, people are paying attention, and this will go on your permanent record, and this will be a stain on your company's name, and this could impact shareholder value and so on and so forth. So consequences, that's the only thing that matters when you're talking about bad actors and bad systems and bad cultural developments. There have to be consequences. Well, here's a consequence that was delivered, and good for Duvall for pursuing it, and for the jury to look past playing racial politics and focus on equal protection under the law, basically. You don't like it, then change the law or attempt to. But there can't be two sets of rules based on your race or your political beliefs or your orientation or your sex. There needs to be one set of laws and equal protection under them. And this is a blow in that direction. So that's good news. Some more good news.
Ooh.
And this comes out of Harvard. So Harvard is also taking a hit.
Yeah,
they're not going to go away. The $40 billion, $50 billion endowment's not going to evaporate overnight. The donations aren't all going to dry up. Let's keep a hold of ourselves here.
Student applications are the lowest they've been in a long time.
Exactly. And remember, so much of Harvard is predicated on prestige, mm-hmm. not just cash on hand. Prestige, status. And you start to have to reach beyond where you normally go in terms of recruiting the best and the brightest, or accepting the best and brightest, no recruitment necessary. You know, people get a little nervous, gets a little jumpy. They've definitely taken some hits. And those hits they've taken, I think, encourage some professors to come forward and talk a little bit about DEI. And they don't like it. A couple of professors inveighing against DEI, Professor Randall Kennedy. By requiring academics to profess and flaunt faith in DEI, the proliferation of diversity statements poses a profound challenge to academic freedom. Playing ball entails affirming that the DEI bureaucracy is a good thing and asking no questions to challenge it, all the while making sure to use in one's attestations the easy-to-parody DEI lingo. It does not take much discernment to see, moreover, that the diversity statement regime leans heavily and tendentiously toward varieties of academic leftism and implicitly discourages candidates who harbor ideologically conservative dispositions. In addition to exerting pressure toward leftist conformity, the process of eliciting diversity statements abets cynicism. Detractors reasonably suspect that underneath the uncontroversial aspirations for diversity statements, more open, welcoming environment for everyone, blah, 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 are controversial goals, including the weeding out of candidates who manifest opposition to or show insufficient enthusiasm for the DEI regime, particularly that last part. Don't stop clapping. Kennedy goes on, by overreaching, by resorting to compulsion, by forcing people to toe a political line, by imposing ideological litmus tests, by incentivizing insincerity, and by creating a circular mode of discourse that is seemingly impervious to self-questioning, the current DEI regime is discrediting itself. It would be hard to overstate the degree to which many academics at Harvard and beyond feel intense and growing resentment against the DEI enterprise because of features that are perhaps most evident in the demand for DEI statements. I am a scholar on the left committed to struggles for social justice. The reality surrounding mandatory DEI statements, however, make me wince. The practice of demanding them ought to be abandoned both at Harvard and beyond. Oh, wow. Wow. Somebody else opined on this, too. Rachel Pritzker. Pritzker. Where have I heard that name before?
Is she the governor? Or president. Oh, no, no. Yeah. Because he has campaign ads everywhere. And nobody knows why.
Rachel Pritzker writing in Chronicle of Philanthropy. Democracy is not the same thing as our preferred political or policy outcomes. We must stand up for our views and contest them in the political arena. But at the same time, we must agree with our adversaries on the rules of the game. If we conflate our policy views with democracy and call opposing positions undemocratic, it is more likely that we and our opponents will be tempted to declare new rules that restrict the other's rights. You don't say. It is thus urgent that supporters of liberal democracy clearly distinguish our policy preferences from the rules of a free and open society. A Pritzker said that. Interesting. Some cracks in the wall of silence that the new Marxists are attempting to erect. That's not to say it's all going our way. That's not to say it's all going our way. And by the way, this is on the ballot in November, as so many other things are. But remember what Thomas Sowell said. If the identitarian left got its way, what would be happening? We'd be killing each other. So it's sort of important. I would put this near the top of the list of concerns. And, you know, and the ideology here informs all sorts of other bad policy choices, from open borders to many others. So, you know, they're interconnected. You know, the philosophical foundation begets all of these chaotic situations that have been imposed. Meet Biden's new State Department Chief Diversity Inclusion Officer. And why the State Department has a Chief Diversity Inclusion Officer is a great question.
Yeah, our enemies are watching this craziness. Okay.
Zakiya Carr Johnson.
We live and work within systems, and those systems, as I mentioned before, are so deeply rooted in patriarchy, in colonialism, in racism, in otherism. We tend to be very resistant to shifts and changes. It's very uncomfortable for many colleagues often when you are the voice in the room that says, this doesn't sound right to me, or I have a question about how this is supposed to work. I want Black women's voices to be heard at the micro level and at the macro level. Often there are just so very few Black women in the room, even when you're talking about a continent full of Black women. The leadership and development circles tends to not be Black women. And it's not because Black women, women of color, are not interested in improving the quality of life or creating opportunities for their communities or for the societies they live in. But it's because we have so many criteria set up to say who is truly a person worthy of being listened to, respected, and...
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll tell you what, Ms. Carr Johnson, take animatronic Anthony Blinken out first in your influence on hiring and firing decisions over the State Department. But this is what I'm talking about. These people have significant influence in government and in corporate America. I think it's waning a little bit, but it's a long fight ahead because we've spent a couple of generations ignoring what has been happening. But some of that pushback that's coming, the litigation in North Carolina, the statements from some professors, including left-leaning professors at Harvard, it's encouraging.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Mr. 10%, the big guy, President Biden, saying of Israel's inadvertent missile strike that killed some aid workers, including one American. Biden, these are Biden's words. Illinois, Israel has pledged to conduct a thorough investigation into why the aid workers' vehicles were hit by airstrikes. That investigation must be swift. It must bring accountability. and its findings must be made public.
Hmm. Wish she felt that way about the border or all the kids that have been killed by fentanyl that has come across the border.
I wish she felt the same way about the 7 kids he droned during the Afghanistan withdrawal.
Yeah.
Oh, right. When we do it, it's a happy accident and move along. It's an unhappy accident, and we just move along, like the entire Afghan withdrawal. It's unfortunate what happened. It was not our intention. But that's all we have to say about it, and that's all we expect anybody else to say about it. Here's some money.
Yeah.
But with Israel, that investigation must be swift. It must bring accountability. Its finding must be made public because, of course, he's preening before a domestic constituency he is trying to bring back into the fold in places like Michigan.
Yep. Swing states where he needs the Muslim American vote.
For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by Cliff May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Times. Cliff, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan and Amy, good to be with you.
So, of course, these occurrences in times of war are tragic and awful, and I'm all for the level of accountability that's called for, and, you know, the rarest of all things, holding someone in government responsible for making a bad call that results in the loss of life. But America generally is sort of living in a glass house on this issue, but particularly this administration, isn't it?
I think that's true. One of the points you've made is that when the United States has been at war, we have inadvertently killed people who were in the war zone. That happens in a war zone. Anybody who goes into a war zone, I have as a reporter, aid workers do, you incur risk. And that risk cannot be negated. In this case, the risk could be negated if Hamas, which has killed dozens, hundreds of innocent civilians, Israelis, Americans, they're holding at least 5 Americans hostage for more than 6 months, torturing them every day. If Hamas would say, oh, well, I guess it's time we release the hostages and put down our weapons, then this would no longer be a war zone. Then aid could go in very, very easily, whether American aid or Israeli aid or U.N. aid or aid from celebrity chefs. That would make things. But it's not simply Israel's responsibility to stop firing at those who have invaded and who have attacked and who are continuing with the war crime of holding Israelis and others in tunnels as hostages where they are abused, tortured, raped, and are dying at a rate we absolutely do not know.
Well, you know, with this aid piece, though, too, you know, we did those airdrops a few weeks back.
2 weeks in a row. Yeah.
And you know, if there was infrastructure on the ground that we could trust, that this administration could trust, of all people, after the exposure of these UN agencies as being infiltrated by Hamas, then we wouldn't be doing airdrops. We'd be working with the infrastructure on the ground to orderly process goods to people who need them in Gaza. So, I mean, what does that tell us about, you know, all of this? You know, with this, it's very sort of generic. We talk about aid and providing aid and we throw money at it and we say we're going to send $60 billion worth of this and $20 billion worth of that. But then you have to get it to the actual people in need. And that's a little bit more complicated, particularly in that region, it turns out, number one. Number two, a lot of those people in need, I'm not trying to be callous here, but are reaping the seeds that they participated in sowing.
All of that is absolutely true. It's important to understand, a lot of people do not, that the problem with aid is not that there is insufficient aid. There's plenty. It's how do you distribute it when you get there. Hamas will take it and bring it down to the tunnels for its fighters. They will also take it and sell it as a way to get additional money to non-combatant Gazans. And it's also, we should be reflecting at some point, we haven't really yet, on what we've been doing in Gaza over since 2007, which is when Hamas pushed out Fatah, pushed out the Palestinian Authority forcibly. Again, they did this by shooting people in their knees, throwing people off buildings, killing people. It was a coup or a small civil war. They've taken over. The Israelis have said, okay, we're out of here. They're out of here. They've been out of there since 2005. What we've done is to say, you know what, let's have the Americans and the Europeans in particular provide loads of aid in every form, and let's have the UN provide all social services, education, clean the streets, potholes, whatever. And the UN will hire Hamas or Hamas-affiliated people for these jobs. And then since Hamas doesn't need to worry about governing Gaza, because that's the money is coming in from the West and the services are being fulfilled with the UN overseeing, again, people approved by Hamas, Hamas can do what it wants to do. It can take on its main mission. Its mission is to plan for a war against Israel. And it will do that by establishing tunnels, for underground fortress, literally hundreds of miles, so that when Hamas invades Israel, then Hamas fighters can retreat to these tunnels, and they will have above these tunnels non-combat human shields. When those human shields get killed, instead of people saying Hamas is responsible for this, Hamas is doing it, they'll say, those Israelis, those Jews, they must be punished. And that's what, and it's what's really interesting is Yahya Sinwar, who is the Hamas chief in Gaza, probably in a tunnel in Rafah. He understood all that. He understood the psychology of the West. He understood how the UN works. He understood how the International Red Cross works. He understood how the media work. He understood what would happen very well. You have to give him credit. He's been very smart so far. May not turn out the way he thinks, but he knew no matter how egregious the war crimes and atrocities he commits, in the end of the day, it's the Israelis, it's the Jews who will take most of the blame from most people.
Let me just one more on this. To ask this a different way in the context of all the protesting that's going on and the overheated rhetoric from, you know, the Kamala Harris's of all people who knows nothing and Macron's of the world, you know, invoking war crimes in a conversation about Netanyahu's management of the war. Is there anything that you have seen reported or that you know from your experience and connections that any instances where you say that Bibi, the Israelis have been reckless or sloppy, not as circumspect as they could have been in the context of what is possible in during wartime, anything where they have been indiscriminate in any way?
No, and quite the contrary. And I don't. And let me just cite the people who I respect on this. John Spencer is at West Point, and he is perhaps the world's expert on urban warfare. And what he has written, he's written in articles. You'll find him on Twitter, John Spencer. Is the name to look for. He said there. This is the standard that Israelis have used to try to protect non-combatants, despite the fact that Hamas uses these non-combatants, women and children as human shields, is beyond what any other army in all history have done. It's gone beyond. And Colonel Richard Kemp is a British officer. Retired, he was the head of British forces in Afghanistan. He's been there for the entire war. He's writing particularly in British papers and European papers, but also you find him on Twitter every day. He also says the same. The Israelis are risking their own lives in order to protect non-combatants, and they're doing so with maintaining a standard that no army ever has done before. You know, we talk about Al-Shifa Hospital, where there's been a big battle. The Israelis, in the most recent battle, didn't have losses. They killed and captured terrorists. They did non-combatants spared. It was quite an amazing thing. But the Israelis didn't need to go into that hospital and do that if they wanted. If they knew there were 1,000 terrorists in that hospital, they could just bomb it and kill everybody in it. That's the normal way these things work in war. The Israelis didn't do it that way. They wanted to separate doctors and patients from the terrorists who were using that hospital as their headquarters, and they did so successfully. You're hearing much less about that than you are about, for example, celebrity chefs' attempts to bring food aid into Gazans, which is a noble thing to do, but understand, and he needs to understand, and those going in, there's substantial risk when you do that, when you go into an active war zone.
Right. So President Biden, we know he likes to talk out of both sides of his mouth, but he was saying that, you know, U.S. troops, we're not going to be sending U.S. troops. Yet, aren't we building that pier right off of Gaza to bring aid in? And who's going to be overseeing that operation?
It's not entirely clear. There's going to be a pier, and then there's going to be a way to get there's going to be a pier to unload it, and then probably boats bring it onto the shore. And then it's not entirely clear, since President Biden says no American boots will be on the ground in Gaza, who exactly distributes that aid. He said, "I want the Israelis to protect the aid." They can do so, but it's not so easy for the Israelis to give out the aid. Hamas will shoot Israelis if they can do so. Hamas will start a riot if they can do so. Hamas will steal the aid if they can do so. The plan does not seem to me, there may be parts that have not been announced, to be entirely coherent and quite thought through. And again, every time we talk about this, we should say, if all Hamas has to do is say, we're not fighting anymore. We're not fighting anymore because we want to spare our civilians. But they don't. They're very open about the fact they use human shields. This is not a theory somebody's come up with. They talk about this. They say we need people to martyr themselves in order to support the resistance. We expect you to do that. That's your obligation. When the Israelis do things as they have done, say, send leaflets, make phone calls, drop dummy bombs to say, get out of these buildings. This is going to be a war zone. What Hamas says is, no, don't leave. You need to stay. The Israelis need to see you there, because then that may deter them from attacking that building that we need.
I want to turn to Ukraine and this idea that is being floated by House Republicans, by Speaker Johnson, that the aid they'll agree to in to send to Ukraine will come in the form of a loan.
Mm-hmm.
Really? If the White House wants $60 billion, let's just use that number. So we'll do a $60 billion loan to Ukraine. Then they're going to pay it back in 48 easy installments. I mean, it's not a loan. This is a country that is looking at maybe $500 billion rebuild cost at this point. Where are they going to come up with any money to pay back anything that America drop ships to Kyiv? I mean, isn't that just a little bit of sort of... I think it's going to be ineffective, sleight of hand or sleight of tongue.
I'm more in favor of it than I guess you are, Dan. I've talked to Newt Gingrich about this. I know that that President Trump thinks this is not a bad idea. This would be akin to what FDR did early on in World War II, which was lend lease. And maybe you get this money back, and that's possible if Ukraine maintains its independence and can again be what it has been, which is a breadbasket for the world. They can be paying you back over time, or maybe you forgive the loan because they're a good ally who has done a great job in diminishing the threat that we face from Russia, which is hostile to America and in an alliance at this point, or an axis, with Beijing, an adversary nation, and with the Islamic Republic of Iran. They're training weapons, Iran sending drones to kill Ukrainians, Russia sending various things to Iran so they can use for their proxies, who are stopping shipping in the Red Sea, Hezbollah, which is rocketing Israel. And, of course, they're also this axis includes Russia, as I said, and China and Iran, but also North Korea and increasingly Venezuela and Cuba and Nicaragua. So I don't think it's a bad idea to say, look, let's make it a kind of lend-lease program. Let's help.
The lend-lease comparison isn't a great one, since we got from Russia and Britain pennies on the dollar in terms of what we provided. So and it's also not a great
one.
If we can
seriously diminish the threat, the military threat Russia represents for 3 or 4% of our military budget, I think that's as a better investment than any
I understand that argument. So make that argument. But don't tell me it's a loan. I mean, it might as well be a student loan that Joe Biden is going to forgive with the political culture in D.C. I mean, come on. So we're not giving them money. It's a loan. Come on.
This is what we're talking about is Washington policy.
Yeah,
I know.
College, you try to find an elegant solution that will make every that will make enough people happy.
Yeah, but
that we don't abandon Ukraine to the tender mercies of Vladimir Putin.
I know, but you know what? I mean, don't
I'm
you think?
I'm over honesty in Washington.
Exactly.
I'm not optimistic we're going to get it anytime soon.
I know, but it's just like don't tell me beautiful lies. I mean, don't treat me like I'm an infant. Just make your case. Make the case like you said. This is a small price to pay for the potential impact. And even if there's ultimately going to have to be a negotiated armistice and maybe at some point in the not too distant future, we're going to have to push that and stop pretending that, you know, we have no say in this. It's all on Ukraine. They can't have it both ways. You can't, you know, just ignore your sponsor and expect a blank checkbook. So at some point, we're going to have to be adults here, too. But I mean, I just, you know, the whole like flim flammery. It's not even good flim flammery. That's the thing, I guess. You know, be better at your job, I guess. I don't know.
Well,
all right.
I'm certainly making the case that we don't let Putin prevail in Ukraine and think that he'll then be satisfied and open a yoga studio in St. Petersburg. He has more on his agenda. If I have to agree to a lend-lease program rather than say yes, let's use 3% of our military budget to decimate Putin's military capabilities. I'm absolutely willing to do that, but I understand. I sort of watch and see how things are done and how the sausages are made in Congress. And believe me, it's not a pretty process.
No, I know. I wish more people would pay attention because, as Thomas Jefferson observed, if people did know, as Bismarck observed, too, people did know, then there'd be a revolution. And that's, I think, the order of the day. Anyway, Cliff, I appreciate it. Cliff May, president of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies and foreign affairs columnist for The Washington Times. Cliff, thank you as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Meet Aisha Siddiqa. She's a climate advisor for the UN. She is there when, I guess, Greta Thunberg is unavailable, because that's what we have now. We have these maladjusted young adults that serve as the face people for these ghastly global villains like Klaus Schwab and his friends at the WEF and, by extension, the UN. Aisha Siddiqa.
And I say this because the climate crisis is not passive. The climate crisis is not a result of natural disasters. It's actually man-made. It's a result of...
I'll say it again, because I think they missed it.
The climate crisis is man-made. And it's not just man-made, it's white man-made. It is a result of capitalism, years of colonialism, years of racial oppression. And so, if you want to get involved, the way that we save our planet is when we protect the most vulnerable communities among us. And this includes Black trans women. This includes Indigenous peoples. And this is why it includes children and young folk. Because when we protect them, then we can protect everybody else. All right.
Snap. If you, I mean, she sounds as young, if not younger, than Greta Thunberg.
Kill Whitey. So if we protect Black
trans
men pretending to be women, then we save the planet from global warming. You're going to have to connect more dots for me, but that's not what Aisha Siddiqa is in the business to do. She's in the business to help to gaslight a bunch of skulls full of mush. Thank you, Rush Limbaugh, into being mindless political activists and spokeshumans, useful idiots for people that are actually pulling the levers and turning the dials, standing behind her in the shadows. Some of her tweets. The white man sits at the highest level of power in the world the same way he has killed, looted, and abused Black and brown people for profit. So has he the earth.
White supremacy would rather take everything and everyone, including white people, with it than give up its hold. White supremacy going after white people. Who's left? I'm not an activist, she writes. I'm a killjoy. I'm what reminds white supremacy of its present-day wretchedness. It is my job to make clear that in the process of killing and consuming non-white, non-male bodies, the white man has brought life as we know it to the verge of extinction. Seems like somebody you could have a productive conversation with.
Yeah.
This is what, speaking of which, in terms of standing up armies of mindless Marxist destroyers of Western civilization like this nitwit, that's what we're going to finance here in America. We're going to finance Biden's climate corps, this green army that he's putting together. That his budget, $7 trillion or so, what's a few hundred billion between friends, includes more than $8 billion for a domestic green political army, modeled after FDR's Civilian Conservation Corps. The Biden administration wants to mobilize more than 20,000 for a climate corps, some 50,000 by 2031. You have Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey from Massachusetts. They want to employ 1.5 million people in the climate corps over 5 years, which is greater than the number of enlisted in our military. Give you an example of what they're financing, because the money is going to left-wing political organizations that present as, you know, the environmental vanguard. According to the Sunrise Movement, the Climate Corps can raise the bar for all employment, allows us to use the government as a way of designing our own society and settling new norms for the workplace. We'll offer a range of compensation and benefits such as housing, transportation, health care, child care, educational credit, scholarships, student loan forgiveness, stipends, non-financial services and benefits that address the barriers to unemployment and job retention, and other benefits as determined by specific program and participant needs. Into the tens of thousands, maybe in the hundreds of thousands, if the blue sky vision can be turned into reality by these Marxists in Congress. It's not all fun and games listening to the Greta Thunbergs and this young lady prattle on. Behind them are people that mean business, like ending free societies in the West. For more on this, Steve Moore, economist and GovZilla author, joins us now. Steve, thank you for being with us as always.
Good morning, guys. Now, how do I sign up for one of these jobs that gives me free childcare, free food, free housing, free
I don't know, you're white.
I want one of those.
Yeah, back it up, white supremacist.
Yeah, you're a killer, looter, and abuser, and you don't care about the environment.
You know, this is a humongous amount of money that they're talking about. This what do they call it, the Green Corps?
Whatever Climate Corps.
Yeah. Climate Corps. I mean, this is just one small piece of the puzzle. I want to remind you and your listeners that there's $350 billion of what I call the Green Energy Slush Fund in the quote, so-called Inflation Reduction Act. And that's just money that $350 billion, not $350 million, $350 billion for programs like this. I mean, it is insanity. We're running a $2 trillion deficit, and they're spending money on all these left-wing groups. And incidentally, when I listened to what you were talking about, Dan, about all these new programs, have you noticed that there's one similarity between every single green anti-climate change agenda item? Grow government. More government control of our lives. This is not about saving the planet, folks. This is about growing the government and having government interference in every single thing that you do in your life, including what kind of car you can drive, because, by the way, in 5 or 6 years, you're not going to be able to buy a gas car.
And then back in the real world, even some enablers of this sort of lunacy are charting a different course, at least in part. I saw the Eva Perón of East Lansing, Gretchen Whitmer, has newfound affinity for nuclear power.
Yeah. I mean, if anybody who's rational and if you actually believe that, you know, fossil fuels are evil, I don't. I think fossil fuels are what make us rich, you know, using cheap, abundant fossil fuels. But if you had to give up fossil fuels, you know, the solution would, that's the other thing. They come up with the most mindless, unworkable solutions to all these things. So, you know, are we really going to run a $26 trillion economy on windmills? I mean, is there any rational person who believes that outside of the people in the United Nations? What you would do if you couldn't use fossil fuels any longer is you'd build, you know, 50 nuclear power plants or 100 nuclear power plants. But they don't want to do that. They want to have control over your life. They want to tell you what kind of car you can drive. By the way, here's the other one. Have you heard about this, Dan and Amy? They want, you know, 10-ton trucks, you know, the long haulers. Yeah. They want 10-ton trucks of the go across the country to be to operate on batteries. Oh, the technology doesn't even exist for that. How heavy are those batteries? Could be another ton of battery. They're going to have to stop every 30 miles to recharge the battery. Oh, how about this one, Dan?
Not enough charging stations.
Yeah, the charging stations. They spent $7 billion in that Inflation Reduction Act on climate on charging stations. You know how many of them have been built, Amy?
How many?
Less than 20.
Oh, that's
well. That's because you don't have enough. You don't have enough enlisted in the climate corps yet. But that's going to change.
it's a $500 million for every charging station.
Yeah, I mean, you laugh about it, but I mean, but they are as serious as a heart attack about it.
They are. Of course they are. I've said this many times, and I'm going to get a lot of hate mail when I say it again, but climate change is not a science, folks. This is not a science. This is the new religion of the left. And these are holy rollers and, you know, anything to save the planet. By the way, I'm also angry this morning because did you see in the new budget, Dan, I've been meaning to mention this to you, we're re-enlisting in the World Health Organization, which is the organization that was the biggest cheerleader for climate change lockdowns. Everything the World Health Organization recommended turned out to be completely wrong, and we're refilling their coffers.
Yeah, well, I don't know why we don't just cut the check directly to the Chinese Communist Party rather than the WHO.
Exactly. Yeah, why do we need an intermediary?
Yeah, right.
I mean, the thing that's so frustrating about this is that, as I just said, you know, folks, we're in debt. We're going bankrupt, and we're spending money like it's candy on things that have no relevance to, you know, how we live and how we work and make America a more prosperous place. I mean, we're giving $250 million more dollars to the World Health Organization after they screwed up everything.
Why would we reward them with that kind of cash or any at all?
I wanted to take some notice of this. We talked a bit earlier about some encouraging developments in revolt against the DEI orthodoxy, diversity, inclusion, equity in corporate America. Yeah. But there was this other thing I didn't mention, and I want to get your reaction to, because this is important. There are studies that McKinsey did about a decade ago and over a few years that people like Mark Cuban lean on to say, it's not just ideological, this race, identity, politics in corporate workplaces. This is not ideological. It produces more productivity for the business. It creates a better work environment. It's a win-win for employers and employees. Well, it's interesting because two accounting professors, one from Texas A&M, one from North Carolina, just looked at this. And here's what they write. Very influential studies, McKinsey reports finding statistically significant positive relations between the industry adjusted earnings before interest and taxes taxes margins of large public firms that basically did the DEI program.
Uh-huh.
That's what McKinsey found. They say we do not find statistically significant relations between McKinsey's measures of executive racial ethnic diversity and essentially the profitability. In other words, the short of it is they could not repeat in their studies using the data that McKinsey used. They could not repeat the results that McKinsey obtained. And so it calls into question these foundational studies that are being used by DEI shills in corporate America like Mark Cuban. This is a big development. It's not going to get a lot of attention, but it deserves attention.
Well, most of the studies are finding that these programs, the ESG programs, the environment, you know, radical climate change programs, and these, you know, by the way, they always use these euphemisms like equity and inclusion. What they're really talking about is just racial quotas. And, you know, so do racial quotas, do all these crazy environmental issues, do they help the performance of the companies? No. In fact, not only did that help, they actually have a negative effect. So last year, in 2023, you know what the worst performing stocks were? Solar power, wind power. You know what the best performing stocks were, Dan?
Those that are not on the government dole. Yeah.
Other than that, oil and gas, you know, so they're divesting in the companies that have the highest return, and they're buying the stocks of the companies that have the worst return. So, you're sugarcoating this, actually. It's not that it would be one thing if they had a neutral effect. These programs don't have a neutral effect. They have a negative effect. And the point that we make all the time is, wait a minute, the purpose of a company, I know I'm going to sound like an evil monopolist here, the purpose of a company is to make a profit for your shareholders, right? And so why are you putting politics over the returns of the company? And by the way, if the company doesn't make a profit, somebody needs to tell this to Joe Biden, this evil company is making all these profits. If a company doesn't make a profit, it's not in business. And if it's not in business, it can hire workers. By the way, I wanted to ask you one thing, Dan and Amy. Are you guys going to $20 an hour on the fast food restaurants like California?
We'll get there. We're first going to attack tipped employees, and then we'll get to $20 an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you see everybody in California? All the fast food restaurants are laying off all their workers.
Right.
And raising prices.
$20. Yeah. That really helps workers.
I wanted to get your reaction to this, too. It turns out that despite Biden's promises of just cleaning up a tax collection, and we're going to go after the millionaires and billionaires. Yeah. 63% of the new audits were taxpayers with incomes of less than $200,000.
Because that's where the money is.
Bingo.
The money is in the hands of the middle class. Obviously, they're going to go after. That was one of the great deceits of hiring 80,000 new IRS agents. They don't need 80,000 IRS agents to go after Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and people like that. They want to go after middle class people who make $75,000 to $150,000, and they're coming after you. And it is this is the time of year when, incidentally, you can't even make heads or tails of what we pay our taxes. We try to do it legally, honestly, and Amy, when we're done, we don't even know if we paid the right amount of taxes. I mean, and then we get a bill. The other day, I'm not making this up, we just get a letter saying, oh, you owe us another $12,000. We're like, why?
Yeah.
Yeah. They didn't even say why. Just send us another $12,000. And I asked my wife, well, what did we do wrong? I don't know. I mean,
every time you send $12,000, a member of the Climate Corps gets his wings. Steve Moore, Wall Street economist and Govzilla author. Thanks as always, Steve. Appreciate it.
All right, I'll get my check right into the IRS because I wouldn't want to put a Climate Corps worker out of it.
No. Exactly.
Do your part. Step up. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So yesterday in Wisconsin, primary election, obviously the presidential candidate's not in down, but there were other matters down ballot that were important, certainly in terms of signaling for November, particularly in a state that is a statistical dead heat right now between Biden and Trump. One of them was this, local race. You don't want to read too much into, but it is interesting because Wausau, Wisconsin went for Biden by 8 percentage points in 2020.
Okay.
And there was a mayor's race there. The incumbent is a woman named Katie Rosenberg, who seemed to be a pretty big proponent of outside interlopers, Mark Zuckerberg's money, Mark Zuckerberg's personnel, serving as administrators in Wisconsin's elections at the local level in places like Green Bay, where Trump was. And she also is one of those you might find in a sanctuary community in Chicagoland who is very welcoming to the Biden buddies that are here illegally.
Oh, I'm Katie Rosenberg, and I'm the mayor of Wausau, Wisconsin. I think the number one job of our cities is to make sure that we are exuding that welcoming behavior that we would like to see. So my goal here is to be as welcoming as possible. And one of the things we did when we started accepting new refugees, we realized, oh my gosh, we don't really have a lot of Dari speakers or Pashto speakers or whatever other language. So we got access to a quick language app. So if anybody in the city encounters somebody that they need to talk to, we're able to call up a translator immediately, show the phone, and have a good conversation back and forth. So that's one way that we are able to quickly make sure that everyone understands what we're doing.
I mean, you mean Google Translate that people have been using for years? Wow.
Yeah, but
so
it's more the attitude. You get it.
I know.
Right? It comes across pretty clearly. Well, she lost to a Republican by 4 percentage points.
4 percentage points?
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, again, I don't want to read too much in it, but it is interesting given her out and proud sort of leftism when it comes to election integrity and open borders. That's number one. Number two, of course, these constitutional amendment questions, banning Zuckerbucks and prohibiting local election officials from outsourcing their duties to private actors financed by third parties like Mark Zuckerberg. And both of those measures, Wisconsin voters approved. No more Zuckerbucks, and election officials, those elected and those administrators hired to be employees in these election departments for the administration of elections. Yeah, they got to be the locals. They got to be the elected official and the people that are full-time, you know, payrollers in those departments, and not political activists that are drop-shipped by billionaires from into local jurisdictions by billionaires from California. Interesting. Interesting. This comes, too, by the way, as some other developments in swing states like Georgia. Senate bill that's going to Governor Brian Kemp, that passed both the House and the Senate, would grant access to Georgia's ballot to any political party that's qualified for the presidential ballot in at least 20 states or territories. That change could make it easier for, say, RFK Jr. to get on the ballot. And as we know from the polling, with RFK Jr. on the ballot, Trump's lead over Biden expands. Also in Pennsylvania, encouraging ruling, a Third Circuit ruling that ends undated vote by mail ballots or vote by Dropbox ballots. This has been going on for, well, since the 2020 election, the failure to to fill in the required date field in vote by mail ballots. And so the Third Circuit said 2-1 this week, that the lower court's position is wrong, cannot be reconciled with the text and historical backdrop of the statute. There's that purposivism that John Kennedy likes to ask Biden judicial nominees about. The point is that the undated ballots that were a source of much consternation, well, that's no longer going to be allowed, or at least allowed under color of law in Pennsylvania. Yeah. So, again, these are not seismic, but they're important. And they're also important because not just in terms of the actual outcomes, but also because it drives engagement, like in Wisconsin, on these issues by the voters. And it sort of puts local officials and state officials on notice that people are paying attention this time around in a way that maybe in some places they were not last time around. One can only hope that the RNC and the Trump campaign, in concert with one another, are making advances with vote-by-mail programs and making advances with ballot integrity programs that will be much more robust come the fall than they were in the fall of 2020. For more on this and updates on Trump's legal matters, because she's hawking the courts in a way that almost nobody else is, we're pleased to be joined again by Julie Kelly. Julie Kelly is, her writings can be found at Substack, Declassified with Julie Kelly. She's also the author of the book January 6th, How Democrats Use the Capitol Protest to Launch a War on Terror Against the political right. Julie, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me on.
I know you're focused on the Trump trials, and we'll get to that. But I know you've written a lot about this topic as well, which is the right and proper administration of elections, ballot integrity. And so, you know, the votes in Wisconsin and some of these developments in the courts, though they've taken a long time, as well as some legislative action in some of these swing states, I mean, they should be somewhat encouraging, even against the backdrop of, I don't know, 7 to 10 million people here illegally that may find their ways on voter rolls. That's certainly a danger. So we have dangers, but we have some encouraging developments, too.
I agree. And look, this speaks to the fact that, you know, more than nearly 4 years after the 2020 election, poll after poll continues to show that at least half of the American public does not believe that the 2020 election was legitimate. And more than two-thirds of Republicans still have that view. Now, they really thought that the events of January 6th and the whole insurrection idea and trying to kick Trump off the ballot and others would quash the interest in making sure that state elections are secure. And now we have the most infortuitous timing for Democrats, where not only you see the backlash from voters, but you see other court proceedings, like in Georgia, there's court proceedings going on about the security of Dominion voting systems, and also new revelations coming out in the D.C. disbarment proceedings going on right now, against Jeffrey Clark, who was one of Trump's top DOJ officials at the time. So, of course, this is very encouraging for our side, because anyone you talk to feels that they're going to be up to the same shenanigans in 2024 that they were 4 years ago. But this is, to your point, I think some encouraging news and putting these election officials on notice that people are paying attention and will be paying attention related to this year's presidential election.
Well, a lot of voter integrity or questions about voter integrity were, you know, came up because it took 13 days here in Cook County for them to count the ballots and decide who, you know, our next state's attorney is going to be.
Well, Amy, and I think that that was interesting, and you see this happening in other places as well. You know, the Democrats have thought that, and their voters, more importantly, that this would only impact Republicans. Right? The Democrats would do this, or whatever the lax voting rules, and all of a sudden coming up with 10,000 ballots somewhere would only be turned against Republicans. But of course, that's not the history. It's certainly not the history in Cook County. But these lax voting rules and suddenly coming up with mail-in ballots or harvested ballots or drop box ballots would only hurt Republican candidates. And, you know, the system is going to get who in office, for the most part, who they want to, whether it's Joe Biden or what we're seeing in Cook County and other places. So, I mean, I think that this is good progress, Dan, to your point, and Amy, yours as well, that, and, you know, voters are paying attention. They want our borders secure. They want our elections secure. They want their kids safe. This is fundamental stuff that the Biden regime is not able to deliver to the American people, and that's why he's on the ropes in all of these polls and desperate to come up with something to make him look reelectable.
Explain the development in the disbarment proceeding against Jeff Clark.
So I'm trying to watch that as well as, you know, what's happening in these various Trump trials. But what's coming out, first of all, Jeff Clark was the acting deputy assistant attorney general. He is the one who drafted that letter to Georgia officials asking for some sort of investigation into what happened there. This is why the D.C. bar is trying to indict him. This is why he is part of Fannie Willis's RICO indictment against Trump and others. It's really preposterous. And he had every right to do this as a Department of Justice official. But what is coming out is how William Barr, the attorney general, and others around him and White House counsel were doing everything that they could to stymie any criminal investigations into these states related to election and voting fraud. And this is something that we were told the opposite of, that Bill Barr came out and said, we looked at this, remember, I think it came out December 1st of 2020. Yeah. we've looked at all these states. There's nothing there. We're shutting down these investigations. Well, what people are saying, officials are testifying the disbarment proceedings, is there was no investigation. To the contrary, Bill Barr, other people who then took his place, Jeffrey Rosen, Pat Cipollini, who was White House General Counsel, they were all trying to prevent people like Jeffrey Clark from pursuing investigations into what we now know and knew at the time were violations, illegalities, breaking state law about voting processes. So this is getting interesting, too. And I think that he is developing now evidence that he can use in the RICO indictment and if Jack Smith decides to bring charges against him as well.
Speaking of Jack Smith, doing his best to get the classified docs case to trial before November 5th. I mean, you know, to trial and adjudicate it before November 5th. It seems unlikely. But yeah, I saw that you pointed out he is on deadline to present draft jury instructions and try to keep this thing rolling forward. What's your handle on where that case stands and the likelihood that that it moves before the election?
I mean, there is a slight chance, but I will tell you, Dan and Amy, the bad blood between Judge Aileen Cannon and the Department of Justice and Jack Smith really spilled over late last night and today, and I'll be posting on @Julie_Kelly, too, about both filings by Jack Smith and Team Trump. Judge Cannon's early request for draft jury instructions on the Espionage Act counts, 32 counts in Jack Smith's indictment, so-called classified documents case. She has asked both sides to prepare that jury instructions will be based on the Presidential Records Act. That Donald Trump, as president at the time, could determine what records were presidential, which ones were personal. Jack Smith, even though you'll recall, this was the entire precedent for moving forward on a criminal indictment for the archives demanding these records back from Trump was the Presidential Records Act, right? We went for months that, oh my God, Trump violated the Presidential Records Act. Well, now Jack Smith is saying, no, the Presidential Records Act has nothing to do with this case, nothing to do with this indictment. He broke the Espionage Act law. And get this, he has no protection based on the language of the Espionage Act or the Presidential Records Act. This all goes back to Barack Obama's executive order on the handling and keeping of classified documents back from 2009. So he is now threatening Jack Smith, is threatening Judge Cannon, either decide on these jury instructions now, which she doesn't have to. They don't have to do this till really the mid or end of trial. And it's completely within her purview. But he is saying, decide these jury instructions. If you're saying that he's going to have protection under the Presidential Records Act, we're doomed. The jury's going to come back with a not guilty verdict. So decide now, because then we can appeal or take, and Dan, you'll understand the unusualness of this, seek a mandamus order from the 11th Circuit, the appellate
right.
order, which is basically telling the appellate court, tell Judge Cannon she's wrong, and you tell
right.
her exactly what to do, which is what we want.
Right. Right. Well, so the other thing I think you tweeted about recently, we mentioned, was based on watching this case proceed as closely as you have, you think that Aileen Cannon may yet dismiss the charges against Trump here in part because of some of the comments she's made or intimated about unequal treatment on this matter of the handling of classified documents.
Right. So I've been to her, the courthouse there a few times, including March 14th. And this was 2 days after former special counsel Robert Hur testified before the American public in Congress trying to explain why Joe Biden would not be charged, even though he's a sitting president and can't be, but will not be charged with harboring classified documents, including national defense information, which represents the counts in Jack Smith's indictment against Trump. And this was 48 hours later in the courthouse, and you could tell that she was really pushing DOJ to explain the unprecedented nature of the charges against Trump, making them confirm that no former vice president or president had ever been charged with this, even though we know that there was history of this, including Joe Biden and even Mike Pence. And she was really drilling down on the unprecedented nature and what they kept calling the arbitrary enforcement of the Espionage Act.
Mm-hmm.
There is a selective vindictive motion to dismiss pending. She has not ruled on that. She also has not ruled on the Presidential Records Act motion to dismiss. So I think this is what she was signaling on March 14th, is if she's going to dismiss this case based on anything, it will be the selective vindictive prosecution nature of Jack Smith's indictment.
Julie Kelly, I wanted to ask you about this relationship between Judge Merchant's daughter and Adam Schiff. I read the headline, too, on another website. I'm like, is this a soap opera? What's going on here?
Amy, I will tell you, just when you think you've seen it all in the Trump prosecutions, this really even stunned me. And this is Judge Juan Merchan, who is the judge in the so-called hush money case. And he has issued this broad gag order against Donald Trump, now including his daughter, that Donald Trump cannot make any comments about his daughter, Lauren. Well, Lauren Merchan is not a 5-year-old, which you would think based on the media coverage and hyperbolic, you know, comments by people like Nicole Wallace. She is a 34-year-old woman who is the partner and president of a very lucrative digital media company called Authentic Campaigns. And she has had this at least 5-year business relationship with Adam Schiff. And she's been paid tens of millions of dollars from Adam Schiff's congressional campaign and now his Senate campaign, going back to 2019 and 2020, when Adam Schiff's campaign paid her $4 million, her company $4 million in 2 years. At the same time, Adam Schiff was leading impeachment against Trump and also bolstering, as I explain in my piece, Michael Cohen, turning Michael Cohen against Donald Trump. And Michael Cohen is now going to be a witness in the hush money trial presided over by her father. So as crazy as the conflicts I've seen between judges and prosecutors in D.C., this takes it to a whole new level.
Well, so and I mean, this is like so straightforward. We talked about this with Andy McCarthy yesterday. First judicial ethics canon is avoid even the appearance of a conflict of impropriety. This obviously has more than at least the appearance, I should say. So you make a motion to for him to recuse himself. He denies it, ostensibly. He will. And then it will be appealed. I mean, I assume that's going to be the Trump legal team's approach, if nothing else, then for the purposes of slowing this down.
Well, this is something important for people to know as they think. Look, Donald Trump's lawyers filed a motion to recuse in May of 2023, and they detailed in that motion all of Lauren Merchant's connections to not just Adam Schiff. She also worked on Kamala Harris's campaign, and she did work for Joe Biden. So they detailed over $72 million in contracts and payments that her company received from Democrats. In August of 2023, Judge Merchan, not sure what the word would be, but he didn't really care, right? Nonchalantly denied the motion to recuse because, as you guys know, it's really the judge's decision to recuse or not. And he downplayed his daughter's association with all of these Democrats, that it did not pose any conflict. And he denied that motion to recuse. Now, it looks like they're going to file another motion to recuse. But in the meantime, you now have this judge with a new gag order covering up his daughter's very lucrative political consulting contracts with all of these top Democrats.
Well,
banning Donald Trump from publicly discussing it.
Well, he's not covering it up very well, is he? Because we're talking about it. He's not going to get. I mean, he may get away with it. He may choose to ignore this conflict of interest. But again, it's sort of like Fani Willis prosecuting Trump in Fulton County. I mean, go ahead, preside over this case and give immediate grounds for appeal, even if Trump loses at the appellate level. With respect to his recusal, it's the same thing. Fani Willis, go ahead, keep her on the case. You're just making it more of a circus. You're just further degrading any prospect that a majority of the country will see these trials as legitimate. So go ahead, you know, do your worst. All they do is they just can't help themselves because they still want to be a part of it for their own status within these political circles. all they're doing is aiding and abetting Trump's political interests. The guy, it's amazing. It's almost like he is picking his enemies. It's almost like he picked Judge Merchant. He picked Fani Willis. It's just remarkable. Julie Kelly, her Substack, Declassified with Julie Kelly, her book, January 6th, How Democrats Use the Capitol Protests to Launch a War on Terror Against the Political Right. Julie, thank you as always.
Thanks, Dan and Amy. Have a great day.
You too. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Little taken aback by some of the commentary on California's new highest in the nation minimum wage law for fast food workers, $20 an hour. Our next guest, Professor David Newmark, the headline of an op-ed he wrote in the Wall Street Journal, California's crazy fast food minimum wage takes effect. Crazy?
Uh-oh. Cray-cray.
I know. It's crazy because it's too low.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
Congresswoman Barbara Lee from California, you remember, I mean, she's done the math. She knows what it actually needs to be. So I assume $20 will just be a way station to get to where it really needs 40. To be.
You're calling for a $50 an hour federal minimum wage. That's seven times the current national minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. Can you explain how that would be economically sustainable for small businesses? You have 60 seconds.
First, let me say I owned and ran a small business for 11 years. I created hundreds of jobs,
right.
Benefits, retirement benefits, also health care benefits. I know what worker productivity means, and that means that you have to make sure that your employees are taken care of and have a living wage. In the Bay Area, I believe it was the United Way, came out with a report that very recently, $127,000 for a family of four is just barely enough to get by. Another survey very recently, $104,000 for a family of one, barely enough to get by. Low income because of the affordability crisis. And so just do the math. Just do the math. Of course, we have national minimum wages that we need to raise to a living wage. You're talking about $20, $25, fine. But I have got to be focused on what California needs and what the affordability factor is when we calculate this wage.
Dinner bell. So it is exactly. The math is so simple. I don't understand. Right? $104,000 per person for an individual to live in the Bay Area that Barbara Lee so ably represents. Simple. $50 an hour times 40 hours a week times 52 weeks in a year. That's $104,000.
Yeah.
Do the math, people. It couldn't be more straightforward. David Newmark, distinguished professor of economics at the University of California, Irvine, the Anteaters, and visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution, joins us. Professor, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. I'm impressed you know it was the Anteaters.
I know every Division I college nickname.
I know. What are the banana slugs? It's one of UC Santa Cruz.
It's one of my points of pride. So, you wrote this piece in the Wall Street Journal. What is confusing about that simple math that Barbara Lee did?
many things. I think there's a fundamental disconnect that people have when they talk about minimum wages, and it's usually those talking about high minimum wages, right? We care, I think, as a society, and it's reflected in every other government program, essentially, about family income, right? You know, the U.S. and other richer countries, we impose some floor on what families are going to have. Whether it's food assistance or energy assistance or earned income tax credit or child tax credit or other ways we get, Section 8 housing, we provide a floor. In the U.S., we do it in a kind of haphazard way, but it's about family income. The minimum wage is not about family income. The minimum wage is about an individual's wage. So you often hear, a family can't get by with one minimum wage worker. Well, the bottom line is most families don't get by with one minimum wage worker because most minimum wages are not the sole breadwinner or the primary breadwinner in their families, right? Who are by far the most common minimum wage workers? They're teenagers.
Right.
Right? And they're teenagers. Why are they low wage? Because they're teenagers. They don't know anything. If I had worked at 16, I probably wouldn't have been worth more than the minimum wage anyway. And as you get older, you know, you earn more. And probably the same with most of your listeners. They had high school jobs. But those people are not in low-income families and certainly not in poor families. If you do the math, the right math, you find that to get a dollar to poor families through raising the minimum wage, you have to increase the wage bill by about $5. And the reason is because less than 20% of minimum wage workers are in poor families. And over a third of them are in families that have above average or above median income. So it's just a very blunt tool. So the first reason is a lot of minimum wage workers are not in poor families, not even in low-income families. And the second is a lot of poor families, even with working-age adults, not retirement-age adults, have zero workers. And the minimum wage does nothing for them. So I am perfectly sympathetic to the view that we need to make sure families have the minimum level of resources. We can obviously all argue about the best way to do that, but this is one of the I won't use the same language the Wall Street Journal put on my op-ed, but this is one of the silliest or least well-targeted ways to do it because it's not directly addressing low family income. It's a law that doesn't say your family income shall not be low. It's a law that says your wage shall not be low. Very crude way to address the problem.
Well, what have
I mean, what's the down? There's no downside. There are studies, Professor, that say this does not increase unemployment. It does not result in job loss. It does not result in price increase. That studies, top men have done studies. So there is no reason not to do this because there is no downside, you see.
Well, they're not just men, first of all, but it's a very small number of so-called top studies that show that. If you put together, as I did, a chart that essentially displays all the U.S. minimum wage studies in the last 20 years, very few fail to find negative effects. And in fact, the ones that get cited the most, the famous New Jersey, Pennsylvania minimum wage study, for example, is absolutely an outlier. It doesn't just find no reduction. It finds massive increases in employment, which I'm pretty sure nobody believes anymore. So the advocates, there is research they can cite. They have to cite it very selectively. Look, and that's true of many issues. I am one who 100% believes there's man-made climate change. Are there studies that say there isn't? Yes. Is it a lot of studies? No, it's very few of the total number of studies. It's one thing to wave a study and say, aha, look, here's the result I want to advocate for. It's another, and it's much harder and more tedious and takes a lot more time to go through all the research and kind of say, what is the overall evidence say? And you got to remember, this isn't a lab science. Like in economics and social sciences, you're not running something under controlled conditions. You shouldn't replicate the exact same estimate of, you know, some physical constant every time. People are looking where minimum wages went up. They're looking where minimum wages didn't go up. They're trying to think about a way to figure out what was the actual effect of the minimum wage once we control for the business cycle and whatever else is going on. It's hard to do. You don't expect every study to give you the same answer, but by the same reasoning, you can't point to one study that's an exception and say, this proves it. Everybody else is wrong.
Well, have there been, since this took effect, have businesses been laying off employees or shutting down altogether? Is there any science and data on that?
Well, it took effect yesterday.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, but to prepare for it, though,
there is,
I mean.
Okay. Yes.
We've seen online. I mean, I don't have like the date stamps on this, but it's been interesting in some of the fast food restaurants, like, 2 days ago, the prices for burgers and fries versus 2 days. I don't know if it's causative or a causal or correlative, but you see price increases at fast food joints on some menus that were screenshotted side by side. So, maybe some fast food proprietors are trying to send a message. And get by.
I don't know if they're trying to send it. I don't think they're in the message sending business. I think
the timing of it. So they knew when it was going to take effect, and they made the change as soon as it did. I mean, that there's a message sending piece to that too, I think. But anyway,
that's true. But it's hard to point to any one event. But the research shows that there is job loss among the least skilled. So we will expect some essentially substitution towards the least skilled labor. fast food restaurants are going to find other ways to get things done. And the most obvious way we see that already, and it wasn't because this isn't the first time we've raised the minimum wage, obviously, is the kiosk checkout instead of ordering from a person. We'll also see somewhat higher prices. So all consumers, now that's not going to be a lot of pain. You know, if your fast food prices go up by 4%, that's a pretty good estimate. It's not a lot of pain, but that's spread over a lot of people, right? So it's diffuse. The worker who keeps their job and earns more will be a lot happier. But the cost is borne somewhere. And people talk about the minimum wage like all that happens is some workers get higher wages and that's it. Now, that's part of what happens, but it's not all that happens. It's kind of like the squeezing a balloon analogy. You know, there's something moves somewhere else. A little less employment, higher prices, maybe we're going to wait longer on lines. You know, there's a funny study, but it seems to be a good one, of the Seattle minimum wage. Restaurants let their bathrooms get a little dirtier, a little less labor. That's a labor-intensive job, right? You can't do that with a robot, or not very cheaply. There's a lot of adjustments they make, all of which impact some of us, and all the other ones are adverse. And as you started with, you know, some businesses that are kind of on the margin will either close or perhaps more likely not open. You know, starting a new – you know, you're open, you're already open. But if you're thinking about, am I going to start a new one here or not, you might say, it no longer looks like a profitable idea, so I won't.
David Newmark, Distinguished Professor of Economics at the University of California, Irvine, and a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution as well. His piece, and he didn't write the headline, I know, California's Crazy Fast Food Minimum Wage Takes Effect. That's in the Wall Street Journal. Professor Newmark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.